Matthew chapter 21. Probably we're only going to get through two chapters tonight because these two chapters, 21 and 22, are absolutely full of Old Testament quotations. So we will see if we can get further than that, but even though we have eight chapters left, these two chapters contain over half of the verses we'll be looking at, so we'll be able to finish next week if everything goes well. Chapter 21, verses 4 and 5, all this was done that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet, saying, "Tell the daughter of Zion, behold, a king comes unto thee, meek and sitting upon a donkey, and a colt, the foal of a donkey." And that quotation comes from Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 9. That's kind of a commentary on what they were expecting and what they got. The Israelites, the Jews, were expecting a conquering king. And we know how silly it would look for a conquering king to come riding in on a donkey. And nowadays, we'd expect him to come flying in an F-16 or something. Or at least riding on a tank, maybe. But even in those days, a conquering king wasn't going to come riding on a donkey. A conquering king would have come on a horse, or maybe in a chariot. Certainly not riding on a donkey. So, Zechariah, in this prophecy, points out something about the Messiah. He's not going to be the kind of king that everybody's expecting. He's not going to come in and conquer the Roman Empire by force and overthrow them. Instead, he's going to defeat them in a far simpler way, and yet at the same time, a far more complex way. He's going to defeat them by changing the very hearts and minds of the people of Israel. And what a difference that is. They weren't expecting their king to come riding on a donkey. They weren't expecting that at all. In fact, some of the earliest pictures we have, drawings from the first century, depict things of people mocking the Christians. And one of the ways that they mocked the Christians was by showing a picture of Christ hanging on a cross and putting a donkey's head in place of the human head, trying to make fun of the Christians that they were following this person that really wasn't worthy of being followed at all, and to mock them in that way. So a donkey is not an animal that is generally highly thought of. They're usually thought of to be somewhat stubborn, maybe not as stubborn as a mule, but at least a little stubborn. Maybe that's where the mule gets its stubbornness. It's the mother, or as the case may be. And would not have thought highly of someone riding a donkey. And it's interestingly enough, it's not the first time Jesus was involved with a donkey. When Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem, there's a good chance that they might have had a donkey along with the trip. The Bible doesn't say so, but there's a good chance of it. Donkeys were not uncommon animals. And so it was not uncommon for people. Even as we see in this case, they find this donkey tied up inside the city. So it was not even uncommon for donkeys to be in the city. Not like our world today, where they don't allow animals in the city very often. Verse 9. And the multitudes that went before and that followed cried, saying, "Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." And this quotation coming from the book of Psalms, Psalm 118 and verse 26. Hosanna is kind of a phrase that would be said in praise of someone, similar to when the English say, "God save the king," or "God save the queen." It's a similar type phrase to that, letting them know that it's an exclamation of praise for this individual. This person is very special. And so we see them saying this to the Son of David. And Jesus, of course, is that one who is the Son of David in the physical side of his lineage, as if he is a descendant of David and therefore a king. As a result of that, David was, of course, the one who descended for the king. All of the kings of Judah came from David through David. Jesus was going to be a king over the Jews. He had to come through the line of David. And then verse 13, he said unto them, "It is written, My house shall be called the house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." So this is kind of an interesting conglomeration of verses. He's actually got a couple of verses in here that he's putting together, and we do that sometimes, don't we? Take a part of one verse, a part of another verse to try to get our idea across. The first part of that, "My house shall be called the house of prayer," is from Isaiah chapter 56, verse 7. Isaiah 56, verse 7. The second part of that, "the den of thieves or den of robbers," is from Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 11. He paints the contrast. Here's what it's supposed to be, and here's what you've turned it into. And it's interesting. Go back to Jeremiah chapter 7 and read that section about what Jeremiah was talking about there when he uses that phrase, "den of thieves." Same chapter 21 still, verse 16. I told you there are a lot of them in here. Verse 16, "And said unto them, Hear thou what these say. And Jesus said unto them, Yea, have you never read, Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast perfected praise." You probably heard that phrase 100 times. Well, out of the mouth of babes. You probably may not have known that that's a quote from the Bible. Jesus quotes that phrase from the Old Testament, from Psalm 8. Verse 2. This was just after, remember, all the people had come out and they'd been saying, "Praise to the Son of David, Hosanna to the Son of David." And the chief priests and scribes were rather upset about this, because that was not the kind of thing that you did. They were putting this man way too high, some of the chief priests and scribes thought. They were lifting him up. Too high, way too high. And so they complained. And they were saying, don't you hear what these people are saying? Jesus let them know that what these people are saying is absolutely right. It's absolutely true. On another occasion, in a similar situation, he tells them, if these kept quiet, the very rocks would stand up and cry out. And there are some things that just can't be kept quiet. The fact that Jesus was the Son of God, was the Messiah, is one of those things that just can't be kept quiet. We sometimes do a pretty good job of it. We sure keep ourselves quiet about it. It can be something that we're not ashamed of at all. We just are letting out here and there and everywhere. And then finally, chapter 21, in this one chapter, 5 different Old Testament quotations, 6 different passages. Verse 42, Jesus said to them, "Did you never read in the Scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, the same has become the head of the corner. This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." And that is a quotation from Psalm 118. Verses 22 and 23. I've heard all sorts of different descriptions about this stone. We think of a cornerstone, of course, we think of the one that where they start. They set the corner right at the beginning of the building, and then they build from there. And of course, a lot of them, it, In your larger buildings, particularly government buildings, you'll find an inscription about when that cornerstone was laid, when the building was completed, and who authorized the building of that building. And certainly they did the same kind of thing back in Jesus' time, and back even to the time of the Pharaohs in Egypt. When they were building a building, they wanted everybody to know which king had said, build this building. They wanted everybody to know when it happened, and when it was started, when it was finished, and all of those things. I've also heard this referred to as being the capstone. Some people have said that it was the final stone on particularly pyramids. If you think about a cornerstone, you might think, well, you have four cornerstones. But some would say you could only have on a pyramid, when they were building the pyramids in Egypt, you could only have one capstone. I don't really see any evidence that that's what this is talking about, but there are some people that believe that that's what it means to refer to. But the point being, Jesus is key. He's the most important stone. And despite the fact that he was the most important stone, the builders rejected him. Now, I heard a story which I'm 99% sure is probably fiction, but it's a neat story, so I'll tell it anyway. The story goes that some people were building a building, and they found this big, huge stone. And they said, well, this is just in the way. We're trying to build here. This is in the way, so let's get rid of it. And they rolled it and pushed it until it got to the edge. It tumbled all the way down to the bottom of the hill. And then they got to the end of the building, and they were looking to put that final capstone piece on it. And they were out of stone. And so they sent to the masons who had cut all of the stone, and they said, send us the final stone so we can finish the building. And they said, we already sent it. We sent it a long time ago. And they got to looking around, and one of them said, that big rock we pushed down the bottom of that hill? And that's it. We went down there, sure, and measured it. Sure enough, that stone was just the right size to fit and finish off the building. They then had to push that stone all the way back up the hill. And as you know, pushing a rock up a hill is a lot harder than pushing one downhill. So, the illustration, though, is before you go rejecting something, you better make sure you know what it is you're rejecting. The Jews made a mistake in that area. They rejected Christ before they even listened to what he had to say. Before they examined what he had to say with the scriptures to see if he was who he claimed to be, to see if he really was the Messiah of the Christ. Hopefully we haven't made that same mistake. There are certainly many who do. They reject Jesus without weighing the consequences of those actions. Chapter 22. Chapter 22, verse 31. But as touching the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, I am the God of Abraham, and the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. This is a quotation from Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. From this verse, Jesus draws a conclusion that to us may seem like we wonder what foundation he had for the conclusion. How does this verse teach that God is not the God of the dead, but of the living? Regardless of maybe perhaps there's more to it that we don't understand in our English translation that was there in the original language, maybe something that we're missing. But at the very least, we see that he makes that statement, God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And then he's talking about the resurrection. It goes on to say in verse 33 that the multitude, when they heard this, they were astonished at his doctrine. So, regardless of how well we understand what point he was making from this passage, There are several things we can learn from. One, it obviously made sense to the people that were listening because they were just amazed, astonished at the doctrine that he was presenting. Secondly, we see that we can and should use the Bible to make logical arguments to help people understand the truth. There's some people that have tried to say that, you know, well, you can't count on the Bible to be accurate and this and that and the other thing. Jesus quoted the Old Testament and many times focused on a single word, one word, letting us know that the Bible is accurate, not just a paraphrase, but it's accurate down to the word. We'll see that in just a minute, that he questions things just specific, very specific about the wording that's used in the Bible. Some people want to ignore it because they don't like a particular phrase that's used. You can't do that. Verse 37. They come and ask him, what's the greatest commandment? Jesus said unto them, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. That's from Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5. That is the greatest commandment. And he goes on, verse 39. And the second is like to it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. That's a quotation from Leviticus 19 and verse 18. Then he says, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Two commandments. If we can do away with all of the other commandments in the Old Testament, those two would have been good enough to live by. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Good principles. If we could even convince the heathen to live by that second principle, it would improve our world greatly. And if we could convince them all to live by that first principle, it would improve their eternity greatly, as well as our world and the world here. Those two, Jesus says, are the greatest of all the commandments in the Old Testament. God gave a lot of commandments in the Old Testament. Those are the two that are the biggest. Then, verses 43 and 44. First, let's ask the question that they asked. Jesus asks them a question. The Pharisees, that is. He asks them the question, what do you think of the Christ? Whose son is he? He said, you know, y'all believe the Messiah is coming. Whose son is the Messiah going to be? Who's he going to descend from? Where is he going to come from? And they said unto him, the son of David. He's going to be the descendant of David. Now watch how Jesus uses the scriptures to confuse and baffle his folks. Verse 43. He said unto them, how then does David in spirit, that means by inspiration is dead, how is it that David in spirit called him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies thy footstool. That's from Psalm 110, verse 1. The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Pharisees obviously understood that this passage was referring to the Messiah, to the Christ. But they hadn't really thought about it. Jesus makes them think about it for a minute. See, perhaps it was that the Pharisees had the picture that the Christ was just going to be a human, a man, a descendant of David. Well, as we discovered earlier, that's true. On his human side, from his human heritage, he did descend from David. But it was much more than that. Because David, Jesus says, called him Lord. I'm going to ask you parents. How many of you parents call your children Lord? Think so. I've known some parents who expected their children to call them Lord, or at least to act that way, bow and cower everything, scrub my boots, that kind of thing. But it does work the other way around, doesn't it? The descendant isn't greater than his father, at least in human terms. Jesus is pointing out to these Pharisees that this Christ is going to have to be more than just a man. Otherwise, David, who the Pharisees and the other Jews as well considered the greatest king that Israel had ever had, and for that matter, the greatest king the world had ever seen. And this fellow, this great king, is calling someone else more. Yeah. There's something more to it. Verse 46 lets us know. They weren't able to answer that one. They couldn't figure it out. We know the answer to that. The answer to that is that Jesus wasn't just a man. Because of the fact that he was part man and part God, he could indeed be greater than any other man that ever lived. Greater than David. And David could look to him and call him Lord. But they couldn't answer that. And it lets us know that from that time on, they didn't even dare ask Jesus any more questions. They were always asking him questions, trying to trip him up, trying to confuse him. But Jesus answered every one of their questions, and finally with this one, he stumped them so bad, they were scared to even ask him any more questions. They were afraid to ask him more questions. Truth will always confound error. It will confuse error to such a degree that the error will run and hide. It always works that way. The truth is properly presented. We can do that as well. We see it. You see folks that come and they want to ask you a whole bunch of questions. If you can answer those questions, they go away. One of two things happens. Either they're thinking about it and trying to figure out what they can do to make themselves better, or else maybe they're thinking about another way to try to trick you because those questions fail. Or it could be they've just said, I don't want to argue with him anymore. Come out on the losing end of that every time. The way it was to Jesus and the Pharisees. They'd ask him all these supposedly trick questions, difficult questions, questions that they hadn't figured out the answer to, and he'd answer them like that. In many cases, in one case in particular, he said to the Sadducees, when they asked him a question about the resurrection, he said, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. He put them in the place. When people come up at us with all these foolish questions, since their question is never a foolish question, there are people who will come with sincere questions. There are plenty of examples of that in the system. But when people come up with foolish questions, try simply to entangle us in a bunch of stories and lead us away from the Bible and lead us into hearsay and legend and myth and all of these kind of things. We need not pay heed to it. We need it all more timid. Avoid such foolish questions. Stay away from it. Tell it. The Bible doesn't want to deal with that. That's what it means. You need to take the book of the Bible. If you're here this evening, you have an angel responding to the invitation for any reason.